Today is October 16th, and this is Kathy with the Vermilion County News, coming from the News Gazette and the Commercial News. So I'm going to start with an article in the News Gazette on the Danville City Council. Use of eminent domain to clear Carl's Way okayed. Haven gaming deal related zoning also given approval by Tracy Crane. Although some aldermen expressed general dislike of a city's ability to use eminent domain to take a person's property, the Danville City Council unanimously voted Tuesday night to use that power for three properties in the footprint of Carl's planned $50 million medical facility. Alderman Bob Iverson, Ward 7, said he really doesn't like the whole eminent domain idea, but he also believes the city should do everything it can to eliminate blight. I deeply feel for this lady, he said, referring to an owner of one of the three remaining properties that have not yet sold. Earlier in the meeting, the council unanimously approved an agreement with Haven Gaming, LLC, to build the proposed casino resort as well as the necessary zoning regulations for the 42-acre site along Interstate 74 east of Danville on the Indiana border. The next stop is for Haven to apply to the Illinois Gaming Board for its state casino license by the October 28th deadline. The eminent domain resolution approved by Alderman Tuesday night cited a blighted neighborhood as the reason to exercise its power per state law. The resolution states that the Danville neighborhood west of the city's downtown, where Carl wants to build a medical facility on about 17 acres, displacing about 66 properties, contains buildings that are dilapidated and deleterious uses that are a detriment to the public health and safety. Negotiations between the city and the affected property owners began around the first of the year, with only two property owners not agreeing to sell. Tamara Lopez, 45, is one of them. She's also one of the few people in the project footprint who lives in the house she owns in a neighborhood dominated by dilapidated rental housing, abandoned properties, and vacant, unkempt lots. The other property owner, Alan Dixon, owns a vacant lot and a building used for storage. Two others listed in the city's resolution signed agreements to sell in the last couple of days, according to Mayor Ricky Williams, Jr. Lopez, who arrived at the end of Tuesday's meeting, said she has been offered $45,000 for her three-bedroom, two-bath brick house, where she's lived for 25 years. She said she can't get a comparable house for that price and has countered with a request for $100,000, but that's not been accepted. Williams, Jr. said Tuesday that she has been offered $55,000. Alderman Brenda Brown, Ward 1, said that when the REG biodiesel plant in Danville wanted to expand, some of the residents whose properties were purchased by that company had lived in their homes for decades, too, and didn't want to move. And they got less money than Lopez has been offered, she said. They were given chump change, said Brown, who added that she wishes someone would offer $55,000 for her house. She said the Carl project will be a benefit to the community, while the REG facility is a project that can be a detriment to people's health. Alderman Steve Foster said that some of the properties along Logan Avenue, including the Lopez house, have been slipping down the hill overlooking Ellsworth Park for years, so selling her property could be good for her. It might be serendipitous, he said. Williams said he also hates eminent domain, but the problem is that the city has a project that's the greater good of the city. It is our great hope we would not need to exercise eminent domain, he said. And a report on the Vermilion County murder trial from the News Gazette. Accounts of death vary widely. Opposing sides differ on how the spouse's fatal injury occurred, by Tracy Crane. The two sides in a Vermilion County murder trial that began Tuesday gave different versions of the events that led to the July 2018 death of a rural Danville woman who was found unresponsive on the bedroom floor of her mobile home 3 days after she and her wife had gotten into an argument. Steve Nate of the Illinois Attorney General's Office said Shelley Murphy, 50, left her wife, Day Lynn, lying unresponsive, beaten, and suffering on the floor before calling anyone for help. She never called 911. She never called for help, he said, during the opening statements of the trial in Vermilion County Circuit Court, which is expected to wrap up Thursday. Murphy faces three counts of first-degree murder in the death of her 61-year-old wife, who was pronounced dead on July 25, 2018, at their home on Vance Lane. Nate said in his statement that the couple had been drinking all day at their mobile home on a Sunday and got into an argument that led to Shelley Murphy allegedly hitting her wife with such force that it tore open veins in her head and bruised her brain. An Illinois State Police crime scene investigator testified Tuesday about the numerous blood-like stains in multiple areas of the mobile home, including the hallway. Nate said Mrs. Murphy was left on the same spot on the floor all day the following Monday and Tuesday, breathing, yet unresponsive, defecating on herself at some point. He said 9/11 was not called until the following Wednesday when Shelley Murphy's sister came to the home to get sunglasses she had left there on Sunday and saw Mrs. Murphy still on the floor. By then, he said, so much blood had filled her head that it had pushed her brain to one side of her skull, and she finally died from that devastating head injury. But Vermilion County Public Defender Mike Morrow countered in his opening statement that evidence will show something entirely different. He said Mrs. Murphy was significantly bigger than her wife and had gotten on top of her during the argument, holding her down and hitting her while Shelley Murphy tried to push her off. Then Shelley Murphy swung, hitting her wife in the head once to get her off of her. He said both had been drinking all day, so Shelley Murphy went to sleep and woke up the next morning to find her wife still face down on the floor. Shelley did her best to take care of her, said Mara, adding that she did not call 911 and should have, but took care of her. He said Shelley Murphy talked to her wife and got some responses, including asking if he wanted her to call 911, to which she shook her head no. He said Shelley Murphy cleaned her up after she defecated and urinated and called her mom for advice, ultimately that her wife was sleeping off the alcohol. Vermilion County Sheriff's Deputy Chris Turner testified that Shelley Murphy told him at the scene that she and her wife had both been drinking heavily on Sunday and had gotten into a fist fight, and Mrs. Murphy laid down and never got up again. Turner said Shelley Murphy told him that she cleaned her wife up after she defecated, gave her ice chips to hydrate, and asked her if she was okay, to which she nodded yes, and if she wanted her to call 911, to which she said she shook her head no. Turner said Shelley Murphy had bruising under one eye and on her arm, while her wife had bruising under both eyes and a swollen area on her head. He said when he asked about the head wound, Shelley Murphy told him that it had occurred weeks ago. And just a little good news piece. Vermilion County Schools students honor fourth grader. Schlarman Academy students gathered in a North Campus stairwell on Tuesday wearing red and black to honor a 9-year-old Georgetown boy who was involved in a multi-vehicle crash a week ago and died from his injuries on Saturday. Wyatt Pope was a fourth grader at Pinecrest Elementary School. His father, Tyler Pope, 29, of Danville, also died as a result of the crash. Georgetown Ridge Farm officials asked schools throughout Vermilion County to honor Wyatt, who was an organ donor, by wearing the colors of one of his favorite sports teams, the Chicago Bulls. Students at Schlarman's North and South campuses did so on Tuesday, donating $1 each for the privilege and collectively raised more than $1,000 for Wyatt's medical and funeral expenses. Church to turn 190. The city's oldest church, First Presbyterian, at 100 North Franklin, will celebrate its 190th birthday Sunday. Among the activities planned, a 9 a.m. organ recital by Ray Wiggs, 11:15 a.m. brunch featuring a presentation by Susan Biggs Warner of the Vermilion County Conservation District, and remarks by State Senator Scott Bennett, State Representative Mike Maron, and Danville Mayor Ricky Williams, and a Lincoln presentation by Murray Cox. And from the commercial news, the headline reads, Council certifies Haven Gaming, so a little bit more information on that. This is written by Jennifer Bailey. City Council members unanimously by a 13-0 vote Tuesday night certified Haven Gaming as the Danville Casino and Resort applicant. Ward 6 Alderman Steve Nichols was absent at the vote. There were no comments on the casino during a public hearing on the certification. The council also approved amending the city's zoning ordinance and map to approve the planned unit development for the casino site south of Interstate 74 and Lynch Road Interchange. Haven Gaming, which was called Celia Gaming, will submit its Danville Casino license application to the Illinois Gaming Board by October 28th. According to the Illinois Gaming Board's website, the 42-page application starts, "The Illinois Gaming Board is pleased to extend the opportunity to submit an owner's license application for the State of Illinois' 6 proposed riverboat casino licenses in accordance with the Illinois Gambling Act. In addition to completing the application, each applicant for an owner's or organization gaming license needs to also submit a separate letter that addresses the upfront license fee to acquire the license, ownership and key personnel, and description of complete legal ownership structure, including partners or affiliates, before and after the license is granted, and including the percentage of ownership interest in the applicant held by minority persons, women, veterans, and persons with disability, affirmative action plan for casino employment, experience of key persons, including brief biographies and gaming operations, and other fields germane to gaming. Details on the proposed location and summary of all discussions with local officials, and the current status of such discussions and development plans. A business plan summary, including budgets and financial statements, and also a timeline for opening the casino after being found suitable for the license. Also, the applicant is to indicate the amount of willing it's willing to compensate the state for delays or changes in the scope of the development. Other information requested, financing, describing the expected capital structure and the sources and amounts of debt financing and equity financing to be employed to obtain, build, and operate the license, including the project development, the expected timing of its availability, and any contingencies. Third-party letters also are to be included, affirming their role and level of interest in providing potential financing. Also indicate the amount the applicant is willing to deposit with the state upon receipt of the gaming license, if awarded. This amount will be non-refundable, subject to meeting the requirements for suitability. Danville Mayor Ricky Williams Jr. says the city only has the name of one investor group so far with Haven, with the rest to be determined. The one known group is Pramana Capital. Additional information to be provided by the applicant to the IGB. Regulatory, internal, and other approvals expect the applicant will be required to receive, and the timing for the granting of all such approvals. Disclose any other facts or circumstances that the Illinois Gaming Board should consider in evaluating the application. The IGB will give careful consideration to applications, which include, but are not limited to, opportunities for revenue sharing with multiple communities, as well as other tangibles or intangibles that would increase the value of the application, and contact information to answer questions regarding the executive summary and application, and of the applicant's financial and legal advisors and external financing sources as applicable. The executive summary, application, and related forms are to be sent to the IGB Chicago address. The $250,000 application fee and $50,000 background investigation fee are to be sent to the IGB in Springfield. And the next article on the front page, police target speeders. Danville police officers are ready to crack down on speeders and other moving violations, thanks to a recently acquired state grant. Speed is heavily related to traffic crashes in Danville, and the Danville Police Department would like to remind drivers to slow down, read a press release issued Sunday by Commander Terry McCord of the Danville Police Department. With the assistance of the Illinois Department of Transportation through a statewide grant, Danville Police will be running several upcoming details through the end of the month to slow down drivers. Motorists are urged to slow down this Halloween when children and families will be walking through neighborhoods and stopping vehicles on the side of the road during dusk and after dark. The public will see extra police cars out and about enforcing Illinois vehicle code laws. Our goal is not necessarily to write tickets, it's to educate and slow down motorists, McCord said. Be alert, be aware, and slow down. We urge motorists to buckle up, leave the cell phones alone, and pay attention to your speed while driving the city streets. The release reminded drivers that when running late, to remember getting there late is better than not getting there at all. Along with speed violations, the Danville Police Department will also be looking for motorists who text and drive or talk on their cell phones without utilizing hands-free abilities. Officers will be also looking for impaired drivers. Even one drink can impair your ability to make responsible decisions, McCord said. This enforcement is made possible by federal traffic safety funds administered by the Illinois Department of Transportation. And now turning to the obituaries. Wyatt Allen Pope and Tyler Pope. Wyatt Allen Pope, 9, of Georgetown, passed away at 8:46 a.m. Saturday, October 12th at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. And from the News Gazette, Iola Mickle. Iola Mickle, 97, of Danville, died at 2 a.m. Wednesday, October 9th at Garden View Manor in Danville. Funeral services will be at noon Thursday at New Life Church of Faith, 1419 North Bowman Avenue in Danville. Pastor Bobby Keyes will officiate. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. to noon Thursday at the church. Leek and Son's Funeral Home at 304 East Williams in Danville is in charge of arrangements. Ruby Winnett. Ruby June Boer Winnett of Livonia, Michigan, and Wichita Falls, Texas, went to join her Lord on Friday, October 4th, at Presbyterian Manor in Wichita Falls. A celebration of life service was held at New Bethel Church in Wichita Falls. Another service will be at the Blurton Funeral Home, Potomac, at 11 a.m. October 18th, 2019, with visitation an hour before, and burial will follow in Partlow Cemetery in Armstrong. A few community briefs from Danville, the Adeline Show Dinner. The Danville Suite Adelines will present its fall show, Wheel of Jeopardy, at 4 p.m. Saturday, followed by a dinner at 6 p.m. prepared by the Danville Area Community Culinary Arts students. Both events are in Dax Bremer Center. Tickets are $10 for the show and $15 for the dinner and are sold separately. Deadline for dinner tickets is today, so call 474-0473. Dance scheduled. Starlight Ball will be at 6:30 to 9 p.m. today in Harrison Park Clubhouse. Bev Wolf and Company will provide the music, and the cost is $10 per person. Church plans a meal. Union Corner United Methodist Church at 14158 Perrysville Road plans its annual chili and vegetable soup supper and bazaar for 4 to 7 p.m. Saturday. Hot dogs, barbecue, desserts, and drinks also will be available. A free will offering will be collected. And from Cayuga, fish fry set. Cayuga American Legion plans an all-you-can-eat fish fry from 4 to 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on Saturday. Cost will be $9 for adults and $5 for children under 12, and dessert is extra. And from Westville, an insect petting zoo will visit the Westville Public Library at 10 a.m. on Saturday. See and possibly even touch some crawly things. Call the library at 267-3170 to register. And this next is an editorial which was first seen in the Chicago Sun-Times on Sunday. A smart way to grow police and fire pensions across Illinois. A state mired in pension debt at all levels can't miss a chance to fix at least part of the problem. Consolidating downstate and suburban police and firefighter pensions, an idea supported by Governor J.B. Pritzker, could do just that. But the Illinois General Assembly must step carefully. Illinois has about 650 police and firefighter pension funds outside the city of Chicago. If you're counting, that's the second highest number of public pension funds in the country. But our high ranking in quantity is not matched in quality. Illinois has the ninth lowest assets per system of any state. In fact, Illinois' assorted police and fire funds, which are required even if a community of 5,000 or more has just one police officer or firefighter, together have gotten themselves into the red by $12.4 billion, or $294,462 per pension fund participant, according to the Illinois Municipal League. Partly, that's due to mismanagement. The Better Government Association in 2014, for example, found that South Suburban Harvey, which had acquired contributions for its police and fire funds of $10.1 million, had in fact from 2010 to 2013 contributed just $140. Part of the problem is also that the Illinois legislature has added sweeteners to downstate and suburban pensions over the years without paying for them. Another problem is rules that limit smaller funds to low-risk, low-yield investments. Over the past 10 years, the unconsolidated police and fire funds have had returns that are 2% less on average than the statewide Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund, which consolidates investments for other municipal workers. Like the successful IMRF, the consolidated funds would be managed independent of state government, which should offer some reassurance to critics such as the Illinois Fraternal Order of Police, who understandably worry about Springfield's abysmal record of handling pensions. The state doesn't have $12.4 billion to fix this problem, nor do local municipalities. But what they can do is to let two professional statewide boards, one for police and one for fire, manage the investments for each individual fund to get better returns and reduce costs. That's the recommendation of a task force report last week, and it makes sense. The Illinois Pension Consolidation Feasibility Task Force estimates net gains could reach from $164 million to $500 million a year. According to the Illinois Department of Insurance, that could lead to as much as $12.7 billion in higher investment returns over 20 years, an amount roughly similar to the level of underfunding right now. The task force reports that a 1967 consolidation in Ohio of funds that had only $75 million in assets and $490 million in liabilities created a single police and fire pension fund that today has a portfolio of $15.7 billion. Skeptics aren't betting on hefty higher returns on investments after consolidation, but even they admit a larger diversified portfolio with lower fees, along with far fewer investment advisors and lawyers than are needed for a 650-plus funds, should result in significant cost savings. But here is where the legislature must be careful. The committee also is recommending pension improvements such as better survivor benefits and an increase in annual cost of living increases for newer workers in Tier 2 who currently get lower benefits than those in Tier 1. Those are laudable goals, but lawmakers had better get their calculators out first. Springfield has a long history of overestimating savings and underestimating expenses when it enacts reforms. Moreover, a study done for the Illinois Public Pension Fund Association, which opposes consolidation, concluded that transition costs could be as high as $155 million, a number disputed by supporters. And there is a risk that better managed local plans will find a consolidated statewide plan does not achieve the returns they are used to, enforcing local taxpayers to chip in to make up the difference. The Consolidation Task Force recommends the legislature act in the veto session, which starts later this month, because in the task force's judgment, the current system is unnecessarily costing us $1 million a day. Many other bills and concerns will compete for the legislature's attention. If it does decide to act on consolidation now, it had better do so thoughtfully and comprehensively so that unexpected problems don't crop up later, as has happened so often in the past. And that was that's from Midwest Voices, which was an editorial in the Chicago Sun-Times. A little bit of high school sports news. Closing kicks. The cross-country course at Kickapoo State Park is a one-mile loop that the runners must cover three times. But on Tuesday afternoon in the Vermilion Valley Conference, it was the final 400 meters that decided the individual titles. Bismarck Henning Rossville Alvin Sr. Gabe Martinez won his second straight league title, while Oakwood Salt Fork Sr. Grace Davis won her first conference title. "This is only my second race of the season," said Marinas, who has missed the first 7 weeks with a stress fracture in his left leg. "Originally, I was thinking about trying to go after the Triple Crown, state titles in cross-country, 1,600 and 3,200-meter races at state track. But with my leg problems, my new goal is to just qualify for state and have a good comeback story." While Martinez is quick to point out that his time of 17 minutes and 35 seconds is well off his career best, being able to outsprint teammate Eli Mojanier, who was second at 17:42, over the final 400 meters was a confidence boost. "It's been tough trying a comeback," he said. "I tried to come back earlier after only 3 weeks, but that was too early and it basically cost me 6 weeks. I've been practicing and training hard to get myself back." His first meet of the high school season was last Tuesday. "It was a very tactical race for me," he said. "I've always been a speed guy, and I like to hold it for the last mile, and that's what I did today, and it worked." Eli has been pushing the team really well this season. "I'm still chasing him as he ran a 16:05 earlier this year at the Spartan Classic. It's been really motivating to try to chase him." With Martinez and Mojanier finishing 1 and 2 would help Bismarck Henning Rossville Alvin claim its first ever Vermilion Valley Conference Championship. The Blue Devils also got a third place finish from Emerson Thornton and a fifth place finish from Michael Mormon. "This is a really sweet day for us," Martinez said. "We've never really been in contention for the team title." Last year, Biz Hen Rossell was second to Chrisman Georgetown Ridge Farm, which had won three state VVC titles entering Tuesday. The Cardinals couldn't defend their title as they didn't have a full team of five runners. Armstrong Potomac finished second. In the girls' race, Davis needed a strong final half mile to catch, pass, and beat Hoopston area sophomore Allison Pickett for the individual championship. Pickett, who had the lead for 2.75 miles, wound up finishing second. The winning time for Davis was 21 minutes, 52 seconds, while Pickett finished in 22:12. She's a really good runner. I expected her to go out fast because I've raced against her a lot this season, and I know she goes out super fast, Davis said. My goal was just to keep her in my sights and try to pass her at the end. That's what happened, but it wasn't without a little drama. I let her get a little too far ahead of me, Davis admitted. I had to put myself into a different gear. I had to get my mindset to go and get my legs to move faster to catch her. It was on that last downhill, pointing to the half-mile marker, that I decided I had to go if I was going to win this thing. Davis pulled even with Pickett with 400 meters left, and her longer, quicker stride allowed the Comet senior to pull away for the victory. I've been training for this all summer and all during the season, Davis said. I think I was third in this race last year, and I was hungry for the victory. Bismarck Henning Rossville Alvin's Lexi Darby, who was the defending champion, finished fourth behind Allie Morris of Oakwood Soft Fork, with Davis taking first and Morris taking third, followed by Cassie Fugate in the seventh and Katie Fritz in the eighth. Oakwood Soft Fork claimed its second straight team title, thanks in part, large part, to a 13th place finish from Aubrey Wells. We've had a lot of trouble with injuries this year, said Davis, as Mackenzie Russell, who was fourth in last year's meet, is still in a walking boot. We needed Aubrey to be our fifth to win the team title. Having a full team is really important. Without a full team, you are just an individual, but having a team pushes you to try and finish one spot higher for your teammates. The same teams will be back at Kickapoo next Tuesday for the Vermilion County meet. And from Tolono, the Bismarck Henning Rossville Alvin boys soccer team got things going in playoff action on Tuesday against a familiar foe. The Blue Devils took on Vermilion Valley Conference foe Oakwood Salt Fork in a regional semifinal at Unity High School, and BHRA would come away with a 7-0 win. Drew Reefsteck had a hat trick for the BHRA, while Cameron Douglas had two goals. Liam Oxendine and Hayden Rice each had a goal, and Ethan Hickman, Nathan Dice, and Andrew Tingley each had one assist. Garrett Hulls had three saves for the Blue Devils, who are 19-0 and will face the winner of today's game against Unity and Fisher on Saturday at 11 a.m. for the regional title. The Corn Jerkers jumped out to a 5-0 halftime lead, and we go on to win an IHSA regional match against the Cardinals. Neil Williams and Isaias Diaz each had two goals for Hoopston area, while Josh Delfino and Lucas Hofer each had a goal and an assist. Ben Brown had a goal, and Diaz and Rice Root each had an assist. Peyton Berlin hit six saves in the goal for the Corn Jerkers, who are 21-4-1, and will face either Hersher or Grant Park on Saturday at 1 p.m. for the regional title. And in prep volleyball, from Armstrong, who beat Schlarman 2-1, Emma Franzen hit 12 kills, 3 blocks, 3 aces, and 26 digs as the Trojans beat the Hilltoppers 23-25, 25-23, and 25-18. Reese Adkins hit 6 kills and 5 aces for Armstrong Potomac, while Emma Jamison hit 5 kills and 4 aces. Maddie Kennel had 10 kills and 14 digs, and Lily Jamison had 32 assists, 3 aces, and 15 digs. Emma Bogan had 17 kills and 7 assists for Schlarman Academy, while Cece DiMiliano had 9 kills and 16 assists, and Tana Cedar added 5 kills. From Hoopston, Emily Meidel had 11 kills, 4 blocks, and 7 digs as the Blue Devils beat the Corn Jerkers 25-21 and 25-18. And that's all we have time for today. Hope you enjoyed listening to the Vermilion County News. You know we're on 3 times a day now, afternoon, night, and overnight. Stay tuned for the next paper coming up. This is Kathy wishing you a good day.